the company they kept by Roger Lowenstein. And the old days in Caldersport, a tiny Pennsylvania town, at the northern edge of Appalachia, if you had trouble with your cable hookup, you simply called John Rikus to come over and fix it. If you needed a loan, or a few bucks for a local charity drive, you darn sure called him too. There didn't seem to be anyone in this town of 2,600 that Rikus wouldn't help, or didn't like, which is maybe why Rikus seemed cut from the same cloth as his idol, the pundit Will Rogers. Rikus's other hero was Sam Walton, and like the folksy Walton, Rikus built his company, Adelphia Communications, from scratch into a giant corporation. This sort of story has become so familiar in recent years that you almost don't have to add a kicker. Yes, it all came tumbling down. Yes, Rikus's company failed, and Rikus himself, along with two of his sons, is sitting in the dock, accused of the worst case of looting of any CEO of the Enron era. The difference is that unlike other supposed villains, Rikus, a 79-year-old son of Greek immigrants, was a genuine business hero, a pioneer in cable television. Many of the current corporate miscreants think Dennis Kozlovsky of Tyco appear to be calculating and utterly unrepentant. Rikus, who has spent much of the past 2 years in a state of shock, is nothing if not likable. And when he goes on trial this month in Manhattan's federal courthouse, the jurors will confront the improbable, a central figure in a white-collar scandal, who is as ordinary as they are. The mystery of how Rikus, a frail, white-haired man, who seemingly had neither the motive nor the disposition to commit a fraud, came so undone, has riveted his hometown. Some say the answer lies with his sons, who directed the company's frantic growth in the late 90s. Others cite the family's habit of blurring private interests and public ones, which was pretty easy to do in a remote company town like Caldersport. Mystery or not, Rikus's fall says a lot about America's wave of business scandals. The explanation put forth by people from Alan Greenspan on down is that executives got greedy, as if that were something new, but Rikus, who never sold a share of his company's stock and didn't get stock options either, doesn't quite fit the mold. So what else was it? However badly the Rikus's behaved, they were helped along the way by lenders and investment bankers, auditors, lawyers, analysts, just about anyone whose job it should have been to protect the public. And this is what truly distinguishes the latter stages of the last bull market, not that a handful of executives got greedy, but that the safeguard supposedly built into our financial culture stopped functioning. The end to people familiar with Wall Street scandal, the central detail of this one remains astonishing. Somehow, the Rikus's persuaded a network of commercial banks to lend to them more than $3 billion, that not only the family, but also Adelphia, a public company with public shareholders, would be liable for repaying. The money was used, in large part, to buy Adelphia securities, which subsequently lost most of their value, as well as to make payments on stock the family had bought on margin. It was also used as a sort of ATM to finance extravagances of the Rikus's, both small and not so small. For instance, roughly $150 million was lent to John's money-losing hockey team, the Buffalo Sabres, $3 million was blown on Songcatcher, a movie produced by Rikus's daughter, Ellen. Then there was the $13 million plowed into an unfinished golf course, a pet project of his son Tim, who had memberships in some 12 other golf clubs courtesy of Adelphia as well. Millions more were squandered by the Rikus's use of the corporate Gulfstream III as a family taxi, particularly to shuttle John's wife, Doris, on shopping trips, and some $45 million was advanced to John, apparently to finance his private businesses. The Rikus's never bothered to disclose that they had borrowed all this, and with Adelphia's guarantee. So when the news broke 2 years ago this March, the public stockholders discovered that they had bought into seriously misrepresented goods. The company collapsed and filed for bankruptcy, and the stockholders were wiped out. The Securities and Exchange Commission, which filed a civil complaint parallel to the criminal case, called it one of the most extensive financial frauds ever to take place at a public company. John Rikus, 47-year-old Tim, who made many of the major decisions in recent years, and 50-year-old Michael adamantly deny the charges. A third son, 46-year-old James, also worked for the company but wasn't indicted. John Anton Rigas, who talked at length for this article, admit to mistakes, but not to any criminal scheme. The hockey money, the margin payments, the jet expense, and the rest wasn't looted, they say, it was borrowed. What's more, they argue that the bank loans were sanctioned by accountants, lawyers, outside directors, and even regulators, and that, had the family's former allies not turned against them, Adelphia would not have collapsed, and their collateral would still be good. Though that may be a stretch, it is undeniable that a lot of people in official capacities were in a position to prevent or force the disclosure of the curious coupling of family and company credit before it got out of hand. For one, Adelphia's independent directors approved the co-borrowing loans. Adelphia's outside auditor, Deloitte and Touche, did urge Adelphia to disclose them, but acquiesced when Adelphia resisted. Adelphia's longtime securities counsel, the distinguished Pittsburgh firm Buchanan Ingersoll, knew about the co-borrowings as well. Finally, investment banks floated billions of dollars of securities to the public with detailed descriptions of Adelphia's finances, that somehow neglected to mention the extra $3 billion of indebtedness. Even the SEC was aware that Adelphia and the Rigas family each let the other borrow on its own credit, an unusual arrangement that, by its very nature, was vulnerable to abuse. But the SEC apparently never investigated it. Later, when the loans were disclosed and the stock began to fall, each of the above parties affected a greed shock. It is not surprising. The scandal has spawned dozens of civil lawsuits, and no one is eager to admit any responsibility. That's the downside of a country run by lawyers. And now that the stock market is back in the pink, a collective amnesia has settled over Wall Street, which takes comfort from the notion that the system essentially worked. The only problem is, it didn't. The mere fact that outsiders knew about the co-borrowings may not get the Rigases off the hook, of course. The indictment charges them with numerous instances of securities fraud, including making false disclosures, inflating Adelphia's results, concocting phony deals with vendors to bolster appearances, and manufacturing evidence. Half a dozen former employees are cooperating with the government, and Adelphia's former vice president for finance has pleaded guilty. Nonetheless, the larger truth is that plenty of people were in a position to have blown a whistle and didn't, for the simple reason that Wall Street, during the 90s, operated like a grander version of Calder Sport, a place where big fish had license to do as they pleased. The failed gatekeeper is a lesson you take away from all of these cases, says Steve Fell, a Fordham University law professor who specializes in security fraud. Auditors who didn't want to lose a client, bankers who were doing a ton of deals. There was a sense in our society that people who have a lot of money are supposed to have it. Calder Sport is a six-hour drive from Manhattan, though you can fly to Buffalo and cut the drive to only 2.5 hours. There are 4 motels in town, 2 stoplights, and a newsstand that sells the Buffalo paper. As a lawyer who has had to travel frequently to Calder Sport noted, the food is awful. The Rigas' presence here is conspicuous. Start along North Main Street with a movie theater, a pre-war, vaguely Art Deco structure that John owns, 2 fronts, down lies the elementary school where his kids got straight A's and that was later converted to Adelphia's headquarters. A bit farther sits the company's new corporate palace with its gaudy Italianate marble columns. Leaving town, you come across a welter of family properties in the shape of curved, stylized barns as if belonging to a giant child's toy set, each sporting fresh coats of paint and identical split-rail fences. The family's main residence is graced by a pond and a weatherproof condo, where swans stay warm in winter. Down the road there is an unattached kitchen for John Chef, a building for Doris's antique furniture collection, a home used for parties, a storage barn for surplus automobiles, a barn-like home that has been given over to the family's lawyers, and a working farm where John produces maple syrup, honey, Christmas trees, and corn. The Rigases dominated the town's finances, In fact, of Calder Sportborough's $564,000 in tax receipts, they and Adelphia contributed close to 40%. Their presence in this perpetually depressed region was also felt in other ways, like the hockey tickets they distributed to school kids and the concerts they staged by out-of-town orchestras. When Gary Francis lost his linen service to a fire, a Rigas assistant drove by at 6 the next morning and offered to help. For the next 7 months, Francis ran his business rent-free from a building owned by Adelphia. People in Caldersport didn't much know whether it was Adelphia or Rigas who was footing the bill for such charity, and they didn't care. People bought Adelphia stock with a similar mindset, because it was Mr. Rigas's company. Some were upset when the scandal broke, but a few months later, when U.S. Postal Service inspectors handcuffed the Rigas's at dawn in their New York apartment and paraded them in front of waiting TV cameras, the home folk rallied. Many people still see John Rigas as a town pillar. Incredibly, even those who have lost money on the stock show no sign of rancor toward him, though their feelings about Tim, who ran the financial side of the company, are not always so charitable. Charles Optigraph Jr., the beefy president of the local Citizens Trust, a century-old bank, said he assumed that John simply could not have behaved as badly as the indictment makes it appear. People are concerned about John, the banker said. As a kid, Optigraph played baseball for John and worked for him at the movie theater. Then, when he was 28, John, a bank director, tapped Optigraph to be Citizens Trust's president. So Optigraph is hardly impartial. But around here, no one is impartial. Donald Gilliland, managing editor of the Potter Leader Enterprise, who has written perceptively about the case, admitted, "It's hard not to like John. I met Rigas, accompanied by his public relations consultant, in the family's two-story legal barn overlooking a hillside where some Rigas sheep were grazing. Rigas was friendly and talkative on two favorite subjects, Will Rogers and baseball. But he seemed confused on various aspects of his case, for instance, when he noted defensively that he didn't own a private jet. It's his personal use of the corporate jet that has been deemed improper. He also insisted that he aims to recapture control of his company, despite the fact that his stock is worthless. The overriding impression is of a man still dazed by his fall. It's pretty frightening," he told me through tears. "I am thankful my parents aren't here to witness this." Rigas was born above his father's restaurant in nearby Wellsville, NY, after serving in the infantry in World War I, and then earning a degree at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute courtesy of the GI Bill of Rights. He moved across the state border to Caldersport at 28 to buy the movie theater. The price was $70,000, which he borrowed from his father, the first of many business deals for which he would overpay and go into hock. It was his friendship with a movie distributor named Sam Milberg that got Rigas thinking about cable. Milberg, a salesman for RKO Pictures, was likewise a child of immigrants, and the movie business was, for each of these men, a laboratory in becoming fully American. Milberg began to warn of the threat to movies posed by television. Hill towns like Caldersport did not get reception, but sooner or later, Milberg said, somebody was going to wire the town for cable. Anyone could climb a hill and build an antenna, but to run a wire across city streets, you needed a license from the city. Operators in remote towns in Pennsylvania, Oregon, and Arkansas began to offer rudimentary cable service. In the late 1940s and early 50s, some of the industry's first moguls were just TV set dealers who figured that cable would drive demand. In Caldersport, a hardware dealer had gotten a license because he figured cable would be good for hardware sales, where the real money was. But he didn't act on it. So Milberg started bugging Rigas to see about buying the franchise. Rigas finally did, in 1952, for $300. He had to borrow that too. With some local movers and shakers as partners, Rigas wired Caldersport. He started with two channels, both of them snowy. A few years later, Adelphia, as he dubbed the company, the name means brothers in Greek, began to acquire more cable systems, and, with every one, went deeper into debt. The rub with expanding a cable business was that you had to invest upfront and then recoup your capital from advertisers and subscribers only later. By the time a system broke even, the operator was usually investing in a new system or in an upgrade of the old one. It's a hard business for a small town banker to understand, Updegraff said. Normally you borrow money and repay it. In cable the debt just grows. Not that there wasn't plenty of upside. In what other industry could you get a government monopoly to provide a service to which people became hopelessly addicted, using a product you could pull out of the air free? The model evolved over the years as networks like ESPN began to charge operators for their programs, but cable companies raised their rates accordingly. In 1975, when HBO transmitted a Muhammad Ali-Joe Frazier fight via satellite, cable took off. Instead of a handful of snowy pictures, systems could begin to offer dozens of clear ones. Operators who had picked up franchises in the early years for the equivalent of $100 a customer became fabulously rich as the price per subscriber vaulted into the thousands. As Leonard Toe, a septuagenarian mogul who sold his cable concern to Adelphia in 1999, put it, a moron can make money in the cable television business. But the persistent need for fresh capital put Rikus in an uncomfortable spot. His competitors were raising money on Wall Street, but Rikus felt strongly about keeping the company under family control. Had his sons not entered the business, Rikus would have kept the company small. He told me I had no plans of being large or wealthy, Rikus said. The first time a banker called on me, I was shocked. The boys all went off to elite colleges and, in two cases, top law schools, but the transition to life outside Calder Sport was hard. Michael had to be talked into going to Harvard. Tim, who went to the University of Pennsylvania, was uncomfortable in the big city. He made a point of telling me that the family had to move from one rented home to the next when the boys were young, which seems to have reinforced their need for roots. James married a pediatrician, started a family, and established something of a separate life. To man, Michael remained weirdly attached to the homestead, where, in fact, they still reside with their parents. The shorthand in Calder Sport is that Michael, who took charge of Adelphia's operations, is deferential and humble, like his father, though something of a recluse. Tim, who is more socially adept, even charming, takes after Doris, a competitive woman, who would berate her husband for being a soft touch. Tim quickly became the finance guy. Tiny Adelphia had trouble getting municipalities to award it franchises over better-known companies. But Tim could persuade the banks to lend Adelphia money so it could purchase systems. The company paid high prices, but generally made its purchases pay off. We were good operators, Tim said proudly. In 1986, Demand James persuaded their dad to take Adelphia public. Like other cable families, the Riguses created two classes of stock, one with super voting rights, to ensure their control. However, the Riguses kept a few of their cable properties separate, in a private partnership, because some partners were reluctant to sell. And then the Riguses continued to buy properties for the family, privately, as well as for Adelphia. I wasn't exposed to all that high finance, John said, but I was always inclined to keep control. When I asked the purpose of such parallel operations, he said he figured that if something ever went wrong with Adelphia, he would always be able to count on the private businesses, as if going public had been some newfangled experiment he hadn't quite bought into. Psychologically, he didn't make the transition to being public. Tellingly, the family paid real estate taxes for Adelphia and for themselves with a single check. In some ways, John's old-style management was endearing. The Riguses were liberal with employee medical benefits and tight with executive bonuses. They generally ignored Wall Street, and like the small-town operators they were, they kept cable prices lower than others. John, however, was in over his head. By the early 90s, he was telling associates that he wasn't fit to run his own company. The line between public and private was hopelessly blurred as the two wings of the House of Rigas traded cash payments, real estate, and personnel to the Riggerses would pay Adelphia for managing their properties, then turn around and insist that the company buy its furniture from Doris, who ran an upscale shop known as Eleni Interiors. The blurriest part of all was Adelphia's board, which supposedly represented the public, a majority of the directors were family members. All this fuzziness didn't seem to bother the increasingly imperious Tim, but it greatly bothered James. He refused free flights on the corporate jet, questioned Tim's plan for the golf course, and even made a point of paying his tax separately from the others. An employer recalled that James also observed that the family's responsibility was to create value for the shareholders. James refused to be interviewed for this article. The Riggerses were usually able to get past such differences and arrive at a consensus. That's how John wanted it. However, when the internet arrived in full force, James increasingly diverged from the family and was eventually made head of a fiber optic subsidiary. It would file for bankruptcy, too, but for reasons relating to economics rather than ethics. The internet turned the cable world on its head. Silicon Valley types began to toss around the term convergence, by which they meant that the telephone, the cable, and the computer-based information highway would become one and the same. It was a repeat of the cable industry's beginnings, forecasts of great profits to come, but in the meantime huge capital outlays. In the latter part of the 90s, cable companies essentially rewired the country for digital TV and the internet at a cost of $75 billion. This was paid for by the public in the form of stocks and bonds. In effect, the cable industry handed investors a gigantic promissory note. The rush on Wall Street created a parallel rush to consolidate. For many cable operators, it was acquire or be acquired. The Riggerses were adamantly opposed to selling out. Adelphia wasn't just their company, it was their life. The brothers, none of whom pulled down more than $250,000 a year, were in for the long haul. They weren't about to move to Chicago or Denver and work for a conglomerate. But the need for capital just wouldn't let up. In 1996, when Adelphia acquired an interest in some cable systems in Florida, the Riggerses arranged for the first go-borrowing loan, one that either they or Adelphia could tap. It was only $200 million, and it arguably benefited Adelphia more than the Riggerses. But the enabling agreement stated openly that the family would use some of the money to purchase stock, and any director who bothered to read it would have known that. The board also might have wondered about the family's strangely cloistered style. Virtually every expenditure had to be approved in Caldersport, usually by the Riggerses themselves. When a field office in Colorado needed a truck, it had to be driven from Pennsylvania clear across the Rocky Mountains. The outside world never seemed to quite get the Riggerses, which reinforced their tribal ways. For instance, when a group of big cable companies banded together to form AtHome to manage the internet side of cable, they refused to let Adelphia become their partner. People said, "We marched to our own drummer," Tim said, but they wouldn't let us join in their parade. Whichever, the Riggerses closed themselves off to virtually everyone outside the family. The exception was James Brown, the young, cocky vice president for finance, who had no formal training in finance, but who became a confidant of Tim's. Tim Riggers and Brown were convinced that in the newly wired world, Adelphia had to grow quickly to stay independent. In 1999, they struck. Three large acquisitions in a single month put Adelphia on the map in California, Colorado, Kentucky, Virginia, Michigan, and parts of New England, 30 states in all. The company was vaulted into sixth place among cable operators, its subscriber total jumping to more than 5 million, from a little over 2 million. Adelphia was suddenly big time. In Caldersport, the family started to strut. Members would boast about jetting off to Los Angeles to see the mayor. Back home, they were demanding improvements to the borough's water facilities and working with architects on plans for a glitzy new headquarters, for which Doris was supervising the choice of fabrics, carpet colors, wall colors, and wood stain. Meanwhile, Adelphia's debt shot up from $3.7 billion to $9.7 billion. It's not unusual in cable for a company to borrow 5 or 6 times its cash flow. Adelphia's debt had risen to a perilous 8 or 9 times. Understand that when cable people speak of cash flow, they mean the money that is earned before companies pay interest and taxes, and also, significantly, before capital projects, like system upgrades. The money that is truly left over, the money that the owners can put in their pockets, is known as free cash flow. It can take years for cable companies to earn free cash flow. Adelphia never got there. As far as investors were concerned, it was always a story about tomorrow. Wall Street has two opinions of such a story. It hates it, or it loves it. In the late 90s, Wall Street loved it. Cable values soared past the $5,000 per subscriber barrier. In 1998, Adelphia's stock more than doubled, and by May of 99, just after the last of the deals was announced, its stock had doubled again, to $86 a share. Most entrepreneurs accept, as a matter of course, that over time, as the business grows, their ownership will become diluted. But the elder Rigas was dead set against it. Tim was, too. Us West didn't have control, and they were snatched up by AT&T, he pointed out. We all felt strongly about this. Given that the Rigases controlled 20% of Adelphia's stock, and about 60% of the votes, they were hardly takeover bait. But every decision relating to the stock was a test of their loyalty. When their sister, Ellen, sold a few shares, the Rigas men snubbed her, as if she had broken with the faith. And they insisted on participating if Adelphia issued more stock. The problem was, they couldn't afford to. Their solution was bold: borrow money from banks to invest. Normally banks don't like to lend for such purposes, because their collateral can go down the drain with the stock market. So Tim Rigas and Brown, his trustee Sancho Panza, proposed that the Rigases share a line of credit with Adelphia to reassure the banks. Tim pitched the idea to the independent directors as a replay of the earlier loan. As then, Adelphia and the Rigases would be co-liable for borrowings by either. Why would the directors let the Rigases borrow on the shareholders' credit? What they say now is that they figured the Rigases would use the money for their cable assets, which would provide ample collateral. However, it was clear then that the Rigases intended to buy securities to keep hold of their company as well as finance their private cable properties. After all, they had done it in 1996. And according to the minutes of a special board meeting on August 23, 1999, at which additional co-borrowings were authorized, the Rigases not only made plain that they intended to keep buying stock, but, indeed, the directors also encouraged them. On Wall Street, the conditions for a capital raising binge were ripe. The repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, a Depression-era banking law, had paved the way for commercial banks, like Citibank and Bank of America, to get into the more lucrative business of underwriting. Adelphia's Brown shrewdly exploited the bank's greed. In a memo to bankers early in 2000, which cordially began, "I hope your new year is off to a great start," Brown pitched the co-borrowing idea and pointedly observed, "All of the lead managers and company managers of each of these credit facilities are expected to have an opportunity to play a meaningful role in public security offerings." In other words, if the banks lent the Rigases / Adelphia money, then Adelphia would spill some gravy onto their investment banking divisions. When the bankers saw that, their mouths watered. This was exactly the sort of conflict that Glass-Steagall had been intended to prevent. The banks went for it. From 1999 to 2001, three banking syndicates, led by Bank of America, Bank of Montreal and Wachovia Bank, allowed the Rigases / Adelphia to borrow a total of $5.6 billion, a staggering sum. Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, Deutsche Bank, and scores of other banks participated. Adelphia, meanwhile, was true to its word. From 1998 to 2002, it went to Wall Street more than a dozen times to issue stock, bonds, notes, convertibles, every flavor in Wall Street's pantry. It raised something like $10 billion, while shelling out $233 million in fees. and syndicate banks like Bank of America were rewarded with lucrative underwriting assignments for their investment banking affiliates. The banking organizations have declined to comment. Generally, they maintain that their two functions, lending and underwriting, were separated by a Chinese wall, and that the underwriters were in the dark with regard to the loans even though they were arranged by their own affiliates. This does not square with the facts. In February 1999, Brown bluntly informed a large group of bankers and investment bankers, "The Rigas family intends to use the proceeds of this distribution to purchase equity securities from Adelphia. Anyone looking for mere gaps in the Chinese wall is missing the larger point. Banks weren't trying to separate departments, but to integrate them. That was the whole reason they had lobbied for Glass-Steagall's repeal. Thus, the banks would send teams of 8 or 10 investment bankers and commercial bankers. No distinction was evident, according to Tim Rigas, to Adelphia, pitching every financial service under the sun. Bank of America's securities unit was so proud of the way it combined its services, which it referred to as delivering the one-stop shop, that it produced a case study for interns in 2001 on how the technique had worked with a particular client. The client was Adelphia. Page after page describes how Bank of America had devised an integrated financing solution for Adelphia, including underwritings, strategic advice, supportive IE, positive research from its analyst, and company borrowing debt. Apparently, the only time Bank of America did not have an integrated approach to Adelphia was when it added up the debt that was disclosed in Adelphia prospectuses. And the Rigases were on an investing binge, all of it on credit. From 1998 on, the family bought a phenomenal $1.8 billion of Adelphia stock and other securities, an extravagance made even more reckless by the securities' high prices. Both Tim and his father were incredibly cavalier about the risk. They craved the growth of a public company and the control of a private one. Apparently, none of their advisors pointed out that these priorities were in conflict. To anyone who knew about the co-borrowing loan, investments of such magnitude could have had only one source. But most investors didn't know about it. Most assumed that Adelphia was selling stock in normal, arm's-length transactions, thus replenishing its capital. Had they known that Adelphia was acting as a guarantor in those sales, they would have realized that Adelphia wasn't really selling stock, it was recycling its own credit. Alvin Davis, an attorney for three of the outside directors, said, "None ever had an understanding that a portion of co-borrowings would be used to purchase Adelphia stock. That was so manifestly improper as to be inconceivable." However, materials distributed at a board meeting in October 2000 made it clear that the Rigases were doing just that. One page of the briefing packet said, "Rigas family to purchase $250 million of an Adelphia stock offering." Another page disclosed that the Rigases were drawing an identical $250 million of the co-borrowing. Such details almost put too fine a point on it. Corporate directors weren't in the habit of challenging management, certainly not on a board where the founding family had a majority of seats. And the interests of the outside directors were, in many cases, somewhat tied to the companies. Erlen Kailborn, a prominent civic booster in Buffalo, was a Rigas family friend and a promoter of Adelphia's plans to build a skyscraper downtown there. Two other directors, Dennis Goyle and Les Galber, were executives at Florida Power and Light, Adelphia's partner in some cable systems in Florida. FPL wanted out, and it was hoping that Adelphia would eventually buy its share, which it did. Davis, the lawyer, said that those directors relied on the independence of the board's audit committee. But by then the audit committee consisted of only Pete Metros, a John Rigas chum from upstate New York, and Tim Rigas, who was the chairman of it. No minutes of the audit committee meetings have been produced, and it isn't clear that the committee formally met. In other words, Metro seems to have been a rubber stamp allowing the company's chief financial officer to supervise himself. He Rigas still had to suffer their outside auditing firm, Deloitte & Touche. Early in 2001, Deloitte began an intensive review of Adelphia's annual report for 2000, due at the SEC early that spring. Deloitte was particularly worried about how to account for the co-borrowing. In previous years, Adelphia disclosed the size of the credit line, but not how much the Rigas entities had actually borrowed under it. In an early draft of the 2000 report, Adelphia stuck with that approach. Deloitte, however, wanted more disclosure. One auditor scribbled in the margin, "Disclose how much drawn." Adelphia's next draft looked no different. So again, a Deloitte auditor suggested the change. Under generally acceptable accounting principles GAAP, a company that guarantees a third party's debt is required to show the loan on its own books if it thinks a loss probable. But even if that standard isn't met, if the guarantor believes there is at least a reasonable possibility of a loss, it has to disclose the contingency, send text, or in a footnote. This was the path advised by Deloitte. Meanwhile, Adelphia was furiously discussing the matter with its securities counsel, Buchanan Ingersoll. Adelphia was one of the firm's top clients, worth $6 million to $7 million in fees a year. Buchanan handled all of Adelphia's securities filings and was intimately acquainted with the company. A spokeswoman for the firm gave me a boilerplate description of its involvement, appropriate, and professional legal advice based on the information we were given. She added that Buchanan didn't know the breakdown of the Rigas' private debt. But on March 27, just before the filing deadline, a secretary in Adelphia's finance department emailed Buchanan. "The managed entities have outstanding borrowing of $1,599,733,000 omitted." Allowing for a convenient memory lapse, Buchanan also says that the decision about what to disclose was left to Deloitte. Funny, according to Deloitte, the auditors heard from Adelphia that Buchanan had signed off. In any case, Deloitte was still seeking fuller disclosure on March 29, just before the filing was due. An auditor scrawled on draft number 5, "The managed entities have outstanding borrowings of $1,599,733 as of December 31, 2000. An Adelphia employer wrote over it, "No." Tim Rigas, who was glib and low-key in answering almost any question, told me he figured it was enough to disclose the potential size of the credit line, not the amount borrowed. And ultimately, he noted, Adelphia's auditor agreed. That will no doubt be the theme of his defense, blame the gatekeepers. The outside directors approve the co-borrowings, Tim repeated. Deloitte was comfortable with the disclosure. Buchanan Ingersoll was comfortable. He allowed that in retrospect, full disclosure would have been better, but he maintained that at the time, the accounting treatment hadn't been a big deal either way. However, in an instant message that Brown sent to a colleague with whom he had been discussing the co-borrowing, Brown said pointedly, "Tim has this as his highest audit priority." So it appears likely that Tim Rigas was actively involved in the decision not to disclose. That didn't mean Deloitte had to acquiesce. It could have refused to sign the annual report, known as the 10-K. In fact, it was required to do so if it felt the disclosure was misleading. And the filing omitted $1.6 billion of debt. Even if it did sign, Deloitte was obligated to notify the audit committee of any disagreement it had with management. But Deloitte blinked. Greg Dearlove, a 25-year veteran at Deloitte, who was the lead partner on the Adelphia account, justified Deloitte's silence by maintaining that Deloitte hadn't disagreed with Adelphia, but had merely suggested changes to its filing. Indeed, Deloitte, but not the SEC, still maintains that the filing was in accord with GAAP. But the real truth behind Deloitte's passivity lies in Dearlove's admission that on occasion, when he did call the audit committee, only Tim Rigas would show up. In effect, the Rigases had found a way to short-circuit the early warning system. That September, Dearlove resigned from Deloitte, which News Jim Brown described, in an internal message, as a huge bummer. A colleague of Brown's responded hopefully that perhaps his replacement would, similarly, be Adelphia's advocate. A collection of these messages shows the employees in Adelphia's finance department to be increasingly engaged in keeping the lid on the company's accounting. Messages about Sabres games and getting haircuts are interspersed with notes on stretching the numbers, and it is clear that the people in Caldersport were starting to worry that Deloy could be pushed only so far. In November 2001, Brown queried, "I wonder if we can use the impairment rules to create some cookie jars." Cookie jars are places to hide expenses. Tim Worth, a fellow employee, replied, "DT. Deloitte and Touche will be watching that like a hawk." Brown shot back, "Hawks don't catch all the mice." Ominously, the street was focusing on Adelphia's debt, and Adelphia's stock was falling. Moody's, the credit rating agency, downgraded Adelphia's bonds. The one bright spot, Moody's allowed, was the persistent support shown by the Riggises. Indeed, Adelphia maintained that the infusions of capital from the Riggises were deleveraging the company. This was patently untrue. The Riggises weren't infusing capital, but borrowing it. In most cases, their infusions consisted of me recounting entries, whereby money that Adelphia had borrowed from the banks, under one of the co-borrowing arrangements, was reclassified as debt pertaining to the Riggises. And, voila, the debt would vanish from Adelphia's books, though Adelphia, according to the terms of the co-borrowing agreement, remained co-liable for it. By 2002, the total of such vanished debt had soared to $3 billion. Moody's, which couldn't know this, issued a bulletin early in 2002 saying that the outlook for Adelphia was improving. Most of the securities analysts on the Adelphia beat seconded the deleveraging story. Much has been written about stock analysts. They were, it was said, dishonest arbiters and hypartists. Those who followed Adelphia certainly remain bullish, even as the market retreated from its dot-com and news high. But what stands out from the analyst reports is less the hype than the utter superficiality. Nowhere does a reader gain a feeling for what distinguished Adelphia's cloistered weirdness, its familial obsessions, its precarious capital structure, and persistent deficit of free cash flow. The analysts beat their breasts over minutiae, they obsess over stock charts, they deliver pages upon pages of spreadsheets crammed with figures, yet nowhere do they scrutinize, or even critically question, the convenient company projections, on which the numbers are based. In the end, it was a bond analyst who sniffed out the problem. Orrin Cohen at Merrill Lynch had followed the company since 1992 and had been perturbed by the stream of payments that went back and forth between Adelphia and a Riggs entity. Cohen didn't suspect fraud, he only knew that there was something he couldn't figure out and that the company was chary with answers. In particular, no one would tell him how the Riggises were paying for all that stock. Therefore, he wondered about Adelphia's deleveraging story. The large equity issuance does raise some questions, Cohen wrote early in 2002. We are somewhat hesitant to fully endorse the notion that Adelphia is plainly deleveraging for all the right reasons. Around that time, the SEC had persuaded the stock exchanges to amend their rules so that listed companies had to appoint an outside director as head of its audit committee. As of mid-2001, Dan Riggs was out, and Kailbourn, his dad's old friend, was in. Kailbourn wanted to make the committee more rigorous, and in particular, he wanted to know more about the co-borrowing. Deloitte was also insisting on more disclosure. The firm says that its change of heart was triggered by an SEC bulletin from January 2002, which reminded auditors to consider the amounts of any guarantees. But the SEC bulletin didn't change the rules, it merely affirmed them. The real change was that the Enron scandal was headline news. No one wanted to be the next Enron. At the end of February, Adelphia informed the Deloitte team that as of the end of 2001, the Riggises had drawn $2.3 billion under the co-borrowing. Deloitte and Kailbourn agreed that this should be disclosed in a footnote in Adelphia's next 10-K, due on March 31. There is no sign that either regarded the disclosure as scandalous, or even as grounds for rebuke. Adelphia's board meeting in the first week in March, held in Cancun, went off without a hitch. In fact, the outside directors agreed to a substantial raise in the younger Riggises' pay. And by the morning of March 27, the Deloitte team had no major issues with the company outstanding. Adelphia reported its earnings before the opening bell, including a footnote reporting co-borrowing credit facilities balances of approximately $2,284,000 omitted. Wall Street paid more attention to the headline management increases 2002 guidance for digital and data deployments. The stock, which closed the previous afternoon just above $20, headed upward. Then, at 10 a.m., the analyst dialed into a conference call, during which each, in succession, was able to put a question to Adelphia's financial team, Tim Rikus and Brown. Such conference calls are usually scripted affairs in which executives try to seem candid and analysts pretend to be curious. And that's how this one started off. But occasionally, as in presidential debates, a truth is laid bare. Rikus and Brown affected a jocular, eager-to-please manner. The stock continued to rise during the call, suggesting that some analysts were phoning their trading desks. After an hour, Brown said he had time for one last question, which turned out to be from Oren Cohen. Cohen referred to the footnote. "That's an awful lot of debt," he pointed out. Indeed, it was too much debt to be supported by the Rikus's cable assets. "What is backing up that debt?" Either Brown or Tim Rikus replied, "We've not provided any further breakout of that." The unsung Cohen persisted, "Well, is there any way you can provide further breakout? Investors may not read footnotes, but they know when a company is ducking." By day's end, the stock was under $17. Bank of America coyly suggested to Adelphia that they prepare a coordinated spin to handle investor questions. But neither it nor the Rikus's guessed they were on the verge of a crisis. The stock, however, continued to fall. Deloitte, which had been on the verge of approving the annual report, now wanted more information. Eventually, it refused to proceed with the audit. Without a 10-K, Adelphia was in violation of loan covenants, and the news of such troubles kept pounding the stock. The SEC opened an investigation into the co-borrowing, and within 6 weeks, the Justice Department was probing an array of supposed wrongdoing, from falsifying subscriber numbers and cash flow totals to creating phony payment receipts. In the middle of May, the directors Cale Bourne and Metros, John Rikus's former buddies, made a late-night trip to Caldersport and met with the family till well past midnight. Within 48 hours, Tim and his father had resigned from management. Adelphia sent a man to repossess the family's 22 cars. John wondered abjectly, "What will I drive?" The government investigation revealed that the intermingling of private and public accounts was deeper than suspected, indeed, downright epidemic. Because the co-borrowing funds were generally deposited first at Adelphia and then tapped by the family on an as-needed basis, the Rikus's had come to treat the corporate treasury as their own. Usually, when they purchased stock, they didn't pay for it as others did, they merely shifted some of the co-borrowing debt from Adelphia to themselves. And when John needed money for the farm, the money was simply dispersed and noted by a journal entry. Then, at the end of each quarter, the entries were totaled up and an appropriate amount of co-borrowings were reclassified. This process became so routine that even after March 27, when Adelphia came under intense public scrutiny, the Rikus's still tapped $170 million of corporate funds to meet margin calls on their stock. This became Rikus's co-borrowing debt as well. Then, as the stock tumbled toward zero, the Rikus's collateral vanished, meaning that the infamous co-borrowing debt had become Adelphia's problem, after all. The investigation, of course, has revealed numerous problems unrelated to the co-borrowing. Like Allen's movie project, the free use of apartments for family members, a Denver deal that seems to favor the Rikus's personally, and the supposed manipulations of the company's cash flow and subscriber numbers. The outside directors, as well as Deloitte, and also the bankers and lawyers, are right to say that most of these were undetectable. However, they didn't occur until after the co-borrowing began. So you have to wonder if the family's history would have been different if any of its advisors, or even the SEC, had acted on what they did detect and delivered the family a lesson in corporate civics. For the one trait that distinguishes the Rikus's, from virtually every other culprit on Wall Street is that they didn't sell their stock. The evidence suggests less that they intended to defraud than that they intended to hide inconvenient facts until they could be righted. This is also, of course, against the law. It's just a more tragic crime than ordinary looting. Amigas is bitter about his ouster and the way that David Voice, the celebrity litigator hired by the directors, engineered it. According to them, the Rigases stepped down for what they were told would be a temporary respite, then watched in horror as Voice and the directors locked them out of their company and needlessly put it into bankruptcy. We built this company from 45,000 subscribers to 5 million. How did it get to filing for bankruptcy in 2 months? He asked. Tim is fond of pointing out that Adelphia's business did not suffer a downturn. But Adelphia is hardly the first company to suffer a crisis of confidence. The question is always whether a debtor has the financial strength to withstand a crisis. Adelphia did not. The aftermath has been nasty. The independent directors, who oversaw the initial phase of bankruptcy proceedings, produced highly sanitized versions of events to the SEC and to the bankruptcy court. In an effort to renounce a contract between Adelphia and Merrill Lynch regarding a cable system in Puerto Rico, the directors produced a second set of minutes for the board meeting, at which the deal was approved. Merrill says the minutes were altered to hide the fact that the directors, who have sought to distance themselves from the Rigases, had okay with the deal. The directors say their minutes are the accurate ones. All have resigned from the board. Adelphia hopes to emerge from bankruptcy this year, but meanwhile it is in litigation with Merrill, Deloitte, the Rigases, and the banks too. The new CEO, a former AT&T executive, is trying to put all that behind him. A corporate type, he has taken a stock option package and moved the company headquarters to Denver. People in Caldersport, where Adelphia still employs 1,200, are nervous about the company's commitment to the town, but some things have changed for good. The water system is being improved, and they have started serving espresso at City News. And a Chinese restaurant opened. I mentioned to residents that the Rigases weren't very neighborly in what they chose to include in their disclosures, but that isn't what people here are focusing on. They wonder if John will take the stand, and how he will fare, and in the meantime, 300 turned out late last year to wish him a happy birthday. Are we angry? Said Kim Mitchell, a bookkeeper. I wouldn't say so, although the company's collapse caused four of her clients to file for bankruptcy and to stick her with unpaid receivables, she remains loyal. The Rigases did so much for the community. They hired contractors, they modernized the schools, but now she was unconsciously confusing the Rigases with their company and with their town and further embroidering their unhappy saga. Roger Lowenstein is a contributing writer for the magazine and the author of Origins of the Crash, The Great Bubble, and Its Undoing.